Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Today, the president offered his vision for the federal budget. He said the government has lost its way over the last several years, failing to pay for the programs it put in place. But when it comes to cutting spending, he said, better to use a scalpel than a machete. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Wednesday. It is the 13th day of April. Read his lips. No renewal of Bush-era tax cuts. That was the word today from the White House as President Obama laid out his proposal for reining in government deficits. The president called for cuts in domestic and defense spending, as well as more savings in health care programs like Medicare. More on that in a minute. But he also said tax increases should be on the table. Even before the president spoke, Republican leaders called talk of tax hikes a non-starter. Are they really? Marketplace's John Dimsdale has the latest from Washington.
The president called for cutting $4 trillion over a dozen years. The plan includes one element not in Republican Paul Ryan's budget proposal, more revenue. The president would limit income tax deductions and let the Bush tax cuts expire for those earning more than $250,000 a year. Speaking to students at George Washington University, Obama said he and Warren Buffett don't need another tax cut.
Not if we have to pay for it by making seniors pay more for Medicare, or by cutting kids from Head Start, or by taking away college scholarships that I wouldn't be here without and that some of you would not be here without.
The president said more sacrifices from the wealthy will ensure a better standard of living for everyone. Economist Diane Swonk at Mesirow Financial says it's legitimate for tax hikes to be part of the national conversation because without them, we can't bring down deficits.
Anyone who's ever balanced their own household budget knows you got to hit it from both sides.
Swonk says Congress has cut programs and raised taxes at the same time before under President Ronald Reagan. Tax reforms then eliminated special interest deductions and closed loopholes.
Yet the last 25 years has been lobbyists putting all those deductions back in again.
She says simplifying the tax code and eliminating loopholes will encourage job creation and productivity, and that will help afford retirement and health care benefits in the future. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
In addition to taxes and spending, the president had something to say about Medicare.
We will slow the growth of Medicare costs by strengthening an independent commission of doctors, nurses, medical experts, and consumers who will look at all the evidence and recommend the best ways to reduce unnecessary spending while protecting access to the services that seniors need.
It's that last part about reducing unnecessary spending that always hangs up the discussion. As we know, one person's unnecessary could be another person's death panel. As Gregory Warner reports from our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, it's hard to talk about saving money on Medicare without talking about the way we die. And no one wants to have that conversation.
About one-third of the money that Medicare spends on a person's care is spent in the last year of life. So here's one of the most popular proposals to cut those costs. Instead of paying separately for every doctor's visit and every test the person might get, Medicare will pay a lump sum to one agency that coordinates care with the patient.
I believe it's very cost-effective because we're not ordering tests that the individual may not need or want.
Sean Bloom is CEO of the National PACE Association. It's a group of 75 not-for-profit care facilities in 29 states.
We were able to focus on the individual's preferences regarding end-of-life care, which makes the allocation of our resources much more efficient.
How much more efficient?
I can't answer that. That's a highly hypothetical kind of question.
It's also highly controversial, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very highly controversial, correct.
Joel Hay is a health economist at the University of Southern California.
You're not going to be popular in the marketplace if you say that we are the most cost-effective health system around because people associate higher costs with better quality.
And he says recent studies have shown that giving patients more say in their care does not save money for Medicare. As people get sicker, they or their families demand more treatment.
Eventually, you're going to reach a point where there's very little you can do except spend lots of money.
He says that still leaves the tough question of how that money gets spent and who decides where to spend it. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, stocks ended pretty much flat for the day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One key theme in the president's speech was sacrifice. He said Americans and America must learn to live within our means again. That got commentator David Frum thinking about what the focus of the conversation should be.
Here's a helpful way to understand the budget crisis this past weekend. In fact, to understand almost all our politics. At the bottom of so many of our current disputes is this fact. $13 trillion in wealth was lost in the financial crisis. We are arguing over the question, who should bear how much of that loss? And it seems almost all Americans are united in one answer. Not me. Should current Medicare recipients receive less? They filled the town halls of the summer of 2009 to answer, not me. Should more affluent Americans pay more tax? They voted in November 2010 to say, not me. It's not just a budget question. One way to cope with the loss of wealth is through the value of the currency. A cheaper dollar means that Americans buy less of the planet's products and resources. The decline in the dollar acts like a tax on everybody who has dollars. The more dollars you have, the more tax you pay. Which is why people on Wall Street are so angry about the Federal Reserve's current cheap dollar policy. They are saying, not me. If the dollar does not adjust, then nominal wages must decline instead. Threatened with cuts, state and local workers throng the Capitol in Wisconsin to chant, not me. But it's going to have to be somebody. Political leadership faces great challenges conveying this message. But even more than leadership, we have a challenge of followership. Political leaders can help Americans to understand what has happened to our economy. It's up to Americans to hearken to full rather than partisan explanations. Political leaders can offer hope that over time the country will recover. It's up to Americans to understand that recovery does not mean that all houses will recover their 2007 valuations. Political leaders can try to share the losses with as little pain and as much equity as possible under the circumstances. It's up to Americans to accept that equitable does not mean we do it my way.
David Frum was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Today, he's editor of Frum Forum. Next week, Robert Reich. We'll take your views anytime. Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. Radiation leaks from Japan's Fukushima nuclear plant have forced tens of thousands of small business owners and their employees from homes and jobs. Today, dozens of them traveled to Tokyo to protest the Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, and the way it's handling the crisis. All this week, Marketplace's Scott Tong is reporting from Japan on how people and businesses have coped in the months since the earthquake. Today, he meets a nuclear industry scientist doing his bit to get the country back on its feet.
Atomic power engineer Tetsuo Shoji knows the crisis at Fukushima wasn't just a nuclear meltdown. It was a PR one, too.
I cannot say it's better.
The plant's spewing radiation. It's poisoned local food and fish and created an electricity shortage. In the month since the quake, thousands of protesters have hit the streets, demanding that the nuclear industry be reined in. Shoji wasn't one of them.
We cannot stop the nuclear power in Japan.
Shoji teaches engineering at Tohoku University in Sendai and advises big energy firms that help fund his research. He says Japan doesn't have the luxury of sitting on oil and gas reserves like, say, America.
The U.S. is a very different situation from Japan because you have a lot of the natural resources. In Japan, we have nothing.
The country's fossil fuel import bill has quadrupled the last decade. And like the U.S., Japan is addicted to energy. Every subway station seems to boast a light-up vending machine. Japanese toilets have heated seats and lids that flip up and down electronically. It all takes energy. And Shoji says alternative sources, like wind and solar power, just can't produce the amount Japan needs. In his university lab, Professor Shoji tests materials for new reactors. Not that there's much testing these days. His international staff, postdoctoral students, were called home once the radiation level started to rise.
I have three postdocs. France, Bangladesh, China. All of them went back.
But here's the thing. The foreigners may be nervous, but almost all Japanese think the outside world is overreacting. Shoji says that's because the nuclear power company didn't get the message out internationally that this crisis is manageable. That's one explanation. Another is bad planning. Tag Murphy teaches business at Tsukuba University. He says the nuclear, quote, experts never considered some of the really basic questions.
Can you justify why you would want to locate the world's most potentially dangerous technology on some of the world's most seismically unstable ground? Have you thought about that?
Nuclear power is the politically entrenched energy sector in Japan, according to political scientist Andrew DeWitt at Ryoko University. He says that's what makes Tokyo Electric Power, or TEPCO, so tone-deaf.
They want to preserve the status quo as much as possible. I mean, you saw that. They wanted to build two new nukes in the middle of the meltdown. That's how lost in space these TEPCO guys are.
Nuclear expert Tetsuo Shoji is pretty close to TEPCO officials. He figures the industry's PR damage will last 10 years, and he doesn't expect a new nuclear plant until then. In the meantime, he has a job to do.
We need to explain. We need electricity. The economy is strongly based on electricity. No other way.
Shoji has some worries, like a shortage of experienced nuclear engineers down the line, people who have built plants and really know how to manage them. That's why, he says, you need to keep building plants. And, of course, to provide the juice for the world's third largest economy.
And if we stop all plant, of course, we have no electricity. It's a disaster. Dark.
In Sendai, Japan, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, in our ongoing coverage of post-crisis Japan, Scott meets a young Japanese businessman who says entrepreneurs are the best hope for restoring the country's economy. And now let's do the numbers. Wall Street climbed out of its early session doldrums to finish just a tad higher today. The Dow edged up 7 points, a tiny fraction of a percent, to finish at 12,720. The Nasdaq climbed 16 points, more than a half a percent, and closed at 2761. The S&P 500 just barely snapped its four-day losing streak, adding a fraction of a point, wrapping up virtually flat at 1314. Financial stocks took a beating today. J.P. Morgan Chase lost 0.8%, but the news was even worse for Wells Fargo. Its stock stampeded downhill more than 2.25%. And investors went on the defensive over the suggested cuts to the Pentagon's budget. Raytheon shares fell nearly 3%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Carbonite Pro automatically backs up computer files to a secure location with anytime, anywhere access from any computer or smartphone. Learn more at carbonitepro.com. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for March. A House Ways and Means Subcommittee discusses the Social Security Administration's role in verifying employment eligibility. And the National Restaurant Association Public Affairs Conference continues in Washington. According to organizers, the industry employs 12.8 million Americans. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
The This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. Today, federal banking regulators announced settlements with 14 of the country's largest home mortgage lenders, including Bank of America, Citigroup, and J.P. Morgan Chase, as punishment for shoddy foreclosure practices, like the robo-signing of documents. The banks will have to overhaul their foreclosure operations and compensate borrowers who were wrongly evicted. The agreements appear to be far less than what state attorneys general are seeking separately. The mortgage servicers neither admitted nor denied wrongdoing. But as J.P. Morgan made clear in its quarterly earning report, the mortgage mess is one of the challenges that weighs on its bottom line. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has details from New York.
On its face, J.P. Morgan Chase had a great first quarter. Profits jumped more than 65% to $5.5 billion. Still, economist Keith Davis with Farr, Miller & Washington says, hold the ticker tape.
The data so far from J.P. Morgan suggests that we're still in trouble.
Davis says J.P. Morgan and all the big banks are actually seeing their business shrink. So they're using money they set aside during the financial crisis to now buffer their bottom lines.
The whole source of that growth is the fact that they took reserves right off their balance sheet and they let them drop to the bottom line. That's not true growth.
J.P. Morgan's retail banking sector lost money compared to last year. That's things like home loans, credit cards, and small business loans. Ken Thomas is an economist with the Wharton School. He says at the same time, there have been new government restrictions on bank lending and fees.
It's been hit by so many headwinds and new regulations. New regulations that remove some of the profitability or a lot of the profitability that was there before.
Profits from former cash cows like overdraft fees and interest rates. And if that weren't enough, banks are also under fire for faulty mortgage paperwork and possibly misrepresenting the investments they sold. J.P. Morgan alone set aside more than $1 billion this quarter for those legal issues. Economist Keith Davis.
We're in a new world now, and the regulators are going to have a lot of scrutiny. Whether or not mortgages are being underwritten correctly, whether or not bank overdraft charges are fair, whether or not credit card fees are fair.
Davis says it will take time for banks to find their footing in this new environment. He doesn't expect real growth to resume for several years. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Why use a cell phone for making phone calls when there's so much other stuff you can do with them? Surf the web, check email, photos, videos, play games, music. You can also buy coffee. And pretty soon, your phone may just replace your wallet. There's word today that American Express is investing in a company called Payphone, phone with an F. It's one of a handful of upstarts promoting the idea that the click of a mouse and the handing over of a plastic card are so yesterday. As our senior business correspondent Bob Moon tells us, cell phones are looking more and more like the way we will do business in the near future.
That old commercial is sounding more and more like history.
American Express traveler's checks. Don't leave home without them.
Turns out you might soon be able to leave home without checks, credit cards, or even cash. And your cell phone could also be the way you'll carry coupons, transit passes, and plane tickets. The idea of using a small radio transmitter for those things has been talked about for years, but analyst Nick Holland with the Yankee Group says its time may have finally come, especially now that the major players in both the credit card and cell phone businesses are rushing to get a piece of the action.
It is a big endorsement from a consumer perspective. You probably get a lot more trust now that you have, you know, these familiar household names endorsing these products rather than it just being kind of startups.
Amex is casting its lot along with Verizon and the company that makes the BlackBerry with a startup called Payphone. Payphone's chief, Roger Desai, says mobile payments can be more secure than using plastic.
So, for example, your phone knows where it is. Your phone has other universal IDs associated with it. And those things are checked on every transaction.
The question is, will consumers now get behind the idea? Bart Narter is a banking industry analyst with Celent.
Folks who are already banked don't necessarily find mobile payments all that compelling because they already have credit cards and debit cards and can make payments.
But Payphone's Roger Desai says a big part of the world still doesn't use plastic.
Estimates show that 5 billion people now carry a mobile phone, and that's growing at still a very fast rate, whereas there's only about 2 billion people that have a credit card.
Those without include a lot of people in the U.S., such as immigrants and the poor. Coming next, possibly, a cell phone that can replace your car keys. You can't leave home without it. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
It's Wednesday, time to hear from you.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
This week's big story is, of course, the federal budget deficit. Commentator Robert Samuelson gave us his take that we are to blame for expecting too much from our government, which in turn makes promises it cannot keep. Danny Collum of Waddy, Kentucky, says the Bush-era tax cuts deserved more attention.
We can't afford it, or its blunter cousin, we're broke, has become the received cliche of the moment. We could afford our current level of services, and lots more to boot, if politicians were willing to tax the people who have benefited so richly from the American system.
Last week, economist Lawrence White gave his ideas for what should replace mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. He thinks the mortgage market can largely be left to the private sector. Rick Monkowskis from Encinitas, California, wondered whether that faith in the market is misplaced.
What will happen is what always seems to happen. We end up with a kind of de facto oligopoly. Look at oil, healthcare, telecom, credit cards, and airlines. We'll get the same thing with mortgages. That is, a small group of companies who have decided what they want to sell and won't offer what is best for the country, just what's most profitable to them.
Also on the program this week, shopping malls. They're losing tenants, even though people are buying more stuff these days, partly because so much shopping has moved online. Catherine Pribilski of New York City senses an opportunity here.
I think the vacancy high is a chance to reconsider the form and for those developers who overbuilt to really and truly consider a mall retrofit that fit in the character or create a character of a community.
If you think we need to reconsider anything we've said on the show or just want to add your 2 cents to the conversation, go to marketplace.org. And you can find links there to friend us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Last year, Americans placed $5.7 billion worth of bets online, and a big slice of those wagers were made in online poker rooms. Cyber poker is still officially illegal in the U.S., and all the big poker providers are based offshore. But the industry estimates that up to 10 million Americans played the game last year for real money. Nevada is moving to legalize online poker in that state, but right now the game is still one of the biggest gray markets out there. A bit of the Wild West in cyberspace. And as Marketplace's Steve Henn tells us, the big poker rooms have to police themselves.
Brian Jetter's a tough guy to track down. For starters, Jetter isn't his real name. When I contacted him, he said he'd only agree to an interview if the phone line was virtually untraceable.
We have enemies.
Jetter is an online poker outlaw. His business is to make and market poker-playing robots, software programs that can log into an online poker game and play against human opponents for real money. They're known as poker bots, and Jetter says playing against computerized poker-playing robots is just part of the anonymous world of cyber poker.
We see it as kind of a natural extension of the online version of the game of poker. We see it as just as natural of a development as playing in your underwear, you know?
Thing is, online poker is struggling to go legit. Half a dozen states are weighing bills that could legalize the game. And having poker rooms infested with players who may not even be human doesn't help the cause. And there's one more problem. Poker-playing robots are getting better.
Oh, very much so. It used to be that poker bots were actually rather weak compared to the best human players.
Thomas Sandholm is a computer scientist at Carnegie Mellon.
There's been a tremendous progress, and actually in Heads Up Limit Texas Hold'em, the best bots have surpassed the best professional human players.
Michael Bowling helped build the best bot. He runs the Computer Poker Research Group at the University of Alberta. So how much money has Bowling made online?
I get that question a lot. And the answer is we don't play our program online for money.
Bowling is in this for the research. He's trying to teach computers to make great decisions even when they don't have perfect information. And poker, where you don't know all the cards in your opponent's hand, is a perfect test case for this kind of artificial intelligence. But Bowling doubts that the commercial poker bots that are usually sold for around $80 are any good. Otherwise, why would they be for sale?
If you had created a program that could actually win money from other players, would you be selling it to somebody else, or would you be using that to win money?
Even Jetter admits the bots he sells can't beat the pros.
The way it comes out of the box is good enough to beat the lower stakes games. It's not good enough to beat the higher stakes games. For me, I make a heck of a lot more money selling picks and shovels than I do digging for gold.
The most popular poker bots have been downloaded tens of thousands of times and raked in millions for designers. So the biggest poker sites are hiring sophisticated computer scientists, including colleagues of Michael Bolling's from the University of Alberta, to track, capture, and kill the poker bots. Last fall, these new bot hunters at Full Tilt Poker caught hundreds of players cheating with bots, confiscated their accounts, and kicked them off the site. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note from the desk of carrying coals to Newcastle. Anyone who's been to China will tell you that actual Chinese food bears very little to no relation to American Chinese food. If it makes you sad that the Chinese are missing out on some really great chop suey, well, put away the Kleenex, because Panda Express may be coming to the rescue. The head of the Panda Restaurant Group told Forbes magazine that he is looking to expand his 1,400-outlet empire to the Middle Kingdom. China, may we present the other General Tso. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 7 points, a tiny fraction. The Nasdaq climbed 16 points, more than 0.5%. The S&P 500 finished basically flat. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Next time on this program, could entrepreneurs be the salvation of post-earthquake Japan?
Entrepreneurs are always doing things. It's inherent, by definition, doing things that other people think are worthless, impossible, or stupid.
I'm Tess Viglin. Join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.